Today is May 8th, 1994. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Alan Paniok, a bush pilot from Barrow, very active in aviation circles, having just given a presentation at the Northern Alaska Aviation Symposium. This tape is made possible by the Oral History Department, Rasmussen Library, University of Alaska. We are recording at the Carlson Center in downtown Fairbanks. You're listening to your talk. Sounds like Barrow is a really tough place to fly. How did you happen to get interested in flying? Is this a long time interest that you had as a child?
Ever since I was 14. I'm the only black sheep in my family that flies. Nobody else in my family does it. I picked up a flying magazine and decided I'd try it. And I got really interested in flying magazines and just got it almost, my family thought I was obsessed with it. And then I went and tried, did the, they call them intro flights, introductory flight for $20. And decided that's what I liked it.
Where were you living at the time?
Anchorage.
So there were opportunities to talk to other pilots and...
I ended up going through Kookamit Native Corporation, Kookamit Regional Corporation, and getting onto a work-study program at Merrill Field, working for one of the flight schools when I was 15, I guess, or 16. Mm-hmm. And I started flying when I was 16. That's how I got, and I started flying at 152s at Merrill Field. Ended up flying a bunch of time in bigger airplanes, 207, and then I got my license in Escutabria. Got my license in 1981.
Mm-hmm. So. I heard somebody say you learn to fly before you learn to drive.
Yeah. I used to get teased relentlessly. Kids in school would think I was really weird taking a bus to the airport to go fly. Yeah, and I didn't know how to drive. So finally somebody said, you know, you're doing this backwards, you better learn how to drive a car.
Drive car first. I guess it's quite expensive to take flying lessons. Did you, well, when you worked there, I guess that was to work off the hours towards flight lessons?
That was supposed to be what was supposed to happen, and then the flight school eventually shut down. And then I think it was a year later, the cooking that came up with a $1,500 dividend.
Oh, so you used that money?
Yeah, that's what I first started to fly with, was that $1,500. Just went into a flight school, plunked it down on the counter, and said, teach me.
And about how many hours does that represent until you actually had your certificate?
Well, I
or
had...
Or years, or however you measure it.
I started flying in 76, and got my license in 81. I had about 475 hours when I got my license.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the time that you were reading about flying, did you have any Alaskan pilots who were heroes to you? Bush pilots, for instance, or female pilots? Anybody that really inspired you that you can think of?
When I was a kid, no.
No, it was just the mechanics of flying that, that really...
The beauty of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I fly for the love of it. No other reason. Let's see, I got Bob Reeve to sign, I got his book and got him to sign it. He's kind of like a...
Your mentor?
Mentor, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the other older pioneer bush pilots that have, that actually braved being up here when I should have been up here doing it. I just got born too late because that's the kind of flying I like to do. Is flying old, loud, smelly, oily, dirty airplanes that go slow.
You know, I read that you're also an antique collector of old airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've bought, sold 10 airplanes and restored one, mm-hmm. restored two.
Mm-hmm.
I had a 1938 Fairchild 24 for a while, which happens to be in the museum in Alaska Land now.
Oh, yes, I've seen that.
Yeah. I had a 1933 Stinson and a conglomeration of other different airplanes, 10 mm-hmm. altogether.
You have your favorite?
My Fairchild was my favorite. Okay. It's my favorite.
So you actually
I'll eventually buy another one.
So you actually got them into working condition so you could...
Yeah, actually I bought the Fairchild in working condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went turbo hunting with it and wrecked it. So I had a break quit on a 15-foot wide strip and the landing gear was 10 feet wide. So as soon as my right foot went to the floor, that was the end of the airplane. And spent 2 months getting it tack welded together enough for me to fly it out of there. And I got it restored after that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the longest 1 hour flight I ever made in my whole life.
And were you out in the middle of nowhere when that happened? So I guess you carried some emergency equipment.
Yeah, there was a cabin there too. I was stuck there for 11 days waiting to get picked up.
What time of year would that have been, in the fall?
It was in September.
September, so it was starting to get a little chilly.
Yeah. But with a cabin there and everything like that, I was just like old home week, just shot caribou outside the door and ate blueberries and
subsisted that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So could have been worse.
It could have been worse because it had, this is a really, it was a very well rigged gold mining camp. And it had a generator there, so I got to watch TV and a microwave and a washer and dryer and a stove and running water. So it wasn't too awful bad in that.
Now, where was this located?
Up on the headwaters of Talkeetna River.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I saw this caribou by the side of the mountain, decided I had to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Got it, too.
Got it.
Got it stuffed. But just the head part.
Uh-huh.
It's my $13,000 caribou.
I was going to say, that must have been a very expensive caribou.
Yeah.
And when did you first start flying as a profession in terms of earning money?
83. I got my commercial license in 83. And then I started instructing in 84.
And this was still down in Anchorage area?
In Wasilla.
Wasilla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was your first paying job then, is in Wasilla?
In flying, it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mostly subsisted on working on Ivory Scrimshaw. And in fact, that took me through a large part of my commercial flight training and other flight training, rental of airplanes.
Oh, so you carve ivory and then would sell the pieces? And
yeah.
So that was your livelihood?
Yeah, and it bought me several airplanes, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so... Must be very talented in ivory carving.
I sell lots. They say I'm talented.
Well, I would think so if you have a lot of buyers out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My first, I instructed part-time, freelance until 86. And then, actually I had a flying job in 85 up by Kotzebue. I flew out of Kiana for a while, but the airplane was not the best of condition, and I wasn't ready to do that yet, apparently, because I went back to Wasilla and instructed full-time at Elmendorf Aero Club in Anchorage for a year.
I guess a lot of pilots do that, give light lessons.
A lot of people do that to gain time. When I went to work for that flight school, I already had 1,700 hours. And the only reason I did it was because I was bored with what I was doing, flying, or I was just working on the ivory.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to get really into flying
one
way or the other, so you gave lessons.
Yeah. And then every time I've been hired, it's been over the phone.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, having interviewed female pilots in the past who are of a different vintage, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier, one that was flying in the Second World War. Did you find it difficult being female to get flying jobs?
No. I was surprised.
Is it still a man's world? Don't you think pretty much so?
Yeah. And I really figured that I would have a problem, and I never had a problem. In fact, I've had people call me up out of the blue wanting me to go to work for them. And this one company in Anchorage calls me annually, wanting me to try to go to work for them. I did find out that in being a female in this man's world, you have to have one heck of a sense of humor. And so, and lots of spirit. And I get by with that. And I think that I've gained the respect of my peers, the male peers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I had a problem with in that respect.
Of getting a flight job.
Yeah. In fact, I got more shock than anything else. I'd fly in on a, land on a tundra or a sandbar to come in and pick up some Eskimo fishermen or hunters or whatever in the 185, little 400-foot strip that has a dog leg in it. And they, I get out of the airplane and they look at me.
Woman pilot?
And they just are in shock, but they'll get in the airplane readily.
So you don't have any trouble getting them in?
No. No, never had any trouble like that. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing. I mean, in this day and age.
Yeah.
I've had other female pilot friends of mine say that they have had trouble, but for some reason I never did. I don't know if it was just time and circumstance.
Yeah.
But I really never did, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your experiences with Cape Smyth Airways. You've been working for them for how long?
Mostly off and on since 88.
And they're based in Barrow?
Yes. And I've been flying for Barrow Air. Excuse me. What happened was I fly for Barrow Air for a while. Then I get traded off to Cape Smyth and fly their fish camps for the summer. And then I went back to Barrow Air and just kind of went back and forth. It was kind of...
There's two air companies then, right in Barrow?
Yeah, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finally went back to work for Cape Smyth full-time in 88. And in the interim, last year in April, I don't know what I was thinking of. In 89, I became chief pilot for Barrow Air. And then I eventually became director of flight ops until a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Then I went into a state of semi-retirement for a year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And finally got bored with that and came back to work in Barrow.
So it sounds like you really love flying up Barrow.
Strange as that may sound, yeah.
Well, it sounds like it's very dangerous flying.
It can be without prior planning.
Yeah, just tell about some of the things you have to do, have to consider there that would be different, let's say, well, in the lower 48, or...
Oh, there's... It's a total world of difference. Mm-hmm. You've got, first of all, 10 months of winter, hard winter, extreme cold temperatures, lots of whiteout conditions, blowing snow. It's totally flat. There's nothing to relieve your eye.
Now, what is it like flying in a whiteout condition?
Like being inside a ping pong ball.
That's a very good analogy.
It was the best one I could come up with at the time, or else the inside of a milk bottle. Mm-hmm. I have felt like that numerous times.
And this can come upon you quite suddenly.
Yeah.
You can be flying.
Very suddenly. And if you're not prepared to transition from flying with a horizon, an outside visual horizon, to flying inside on the instruments, you could die. It just takes control.
Really rely very heavily on instruments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say at least during the spring and fall transitional periods of the weather patterns, mm-hmm. you end up a lot of times on instruments flying in whiteouts. Or in the wintertime, flying in the dead of night when it's 2:00 in the afternoon.
Yeah, you said that there are about 2 months of total darkness. In the winter.
Two months of near total darkness, because you will at 12 or 1 get dusk.
Oh, twilight.
Yeah, mm-hmm. twilight. But that doesn't last very long, and for the most part, the times that I'm flying in the wintertime, especially December, it's going to be dark, especially when you have stratus or clouds, thick cloud layer. For the most part, you're essentially, if I flew 8 hours of flying time that day, it was all nighttime that I logged in my logbook.
Mm-hmm. You differentiate flying
night and day.
Night and day. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I never did really like flying at night, but somehow I got coerced into flying up there. I used to fly for Ryanair and St. Mary's, and I came up to Barrow just to visit. And Barrow Air found out I was up there. For some reason, they had my business card, and they called me for 3 days before I finally relented to going in and talking to them, because I didn't want to fly in Barrow at first. Then he says, $10 an hour raise. I said, okay.
Money talks.
Yeah.
So there is a differentiation in pay and hours mm-hmm. according to day flying versus night.
There's not a differentiation in pay.
But the
differentiation in pay is normal parts of the state, a normal pilot gets $25 to $30 an hour. In Barrow, I started out at $40 an hour. And I make as much as $50 an hour when I was chief pilot and director of flight ops.
Mm-hmm.
The pay up there is, you can't get paid like that anywhere else in the state.
And of course the cost of living is higher too, so I guess that's to compensate for it. Where are some of the areas that you fly to from Barrow?
From Barrow, I go to the smaller outlying villages, Aksuk, Wainwright, Point Lay. And then in the bigger airplanes, we'll go Point Lay, Point Hope, Kotzebue to the west, and then Nooks at Dead Horse and Barter Island to the east. And then, of course, I do the off-airport work, get paid extra for that too, because it's difficult during the summertime. Land on the sandbars and the rivers or on the beaches, and that's a pretty viable thing every summer.
Oh, this is for taking scientists or people in?
I've taken some scientists out. Mostly it's Eskimos going out to their fish camps. We have a map of established fish camps that we take people out to. And that's what we do, is mostly that. Yes. I've taken TV crews out, especially during the deal with the whales.
Oh,
in Barrow.
That was in 1988 or 89?
Yeah, and I've done some animal counts by air using the 185.
Mm-hmm. So you really have had quite a varied amount of work.
Mm-hmm. Now, I used to fly floats too, taking hunters and fishermen out on floats out of Anchorage and Kenai. Flying them out to remote lakes or rivers and dropping off fishermen. I was acting as a quasi-pilot guide, fishing guide, and that was fun work too. I've done that previous years, just keeping my hand in everything.
Yes, sounds like it. Backing up about the whales, could you tell me a little bit more about it? How many times did you go out, and what exactly did you have to land the crews on?
No.
Ice?
No.
Oh.
What I did was the one time I took a Japanese crew out, and they just wanted to fly over the Russian ship. In fact, the three times that I took crews out, they just wanted to look at the lead, the ice, and look at the Russian ship. And when I took the Japanese crew out, we saw a 10-foot polar bear. And they were more excited about the polar bear
than the whales.
Yeah.
So this was more flight scene then?
It was for their films that they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they wanted an overview because they were also being able to go out there on land.
Oh, so they had some crews on the ground too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a media nightmare. The town just blew up with people. And
How did they accommodate everybody?
A lot of
bed and breakfast spring up overnight.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And they were charging people $80 an hour to take sleds, snow machines with sleds out to the whales and everything else. It was a bust.
Real economic boom.
Yeah.
For Barrow.
Yeah. It was pretty interesting to get national coverage like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese crew did get the polar bear on film, too.
So that was a bonus for them.
Yeah.
You've certainly flown in all kinds of conditions. Have you had any sort of close calls because of the weather or mechanical malfunctions?
With mechanical malfunctions, I've had quite a few. And the only reason I say that is because when you fly antique airplanes with engines that are old, you can have more incidents happen. Like when I flew my Fairchild, it's a 1938 airplane, up to Barrow, I had to set it down 4 times due to problems. I've had engine failures, and I had one where I wasn't flying, but we ended up in the trees, broke my back, and I was laid up for 9-10 months, almost a year. But as soon as I was able to walk around, I just got back in the airplane, kept on going.
Say, get up and do it again.
Yeah.
So you didn't have a fear of...
No, it didn't bother me at all. In fact, I've had to set an airplane down in the trees again after that, in a later year. And that one I ended up repairing by myself and flying it back out because nobody knew where I was at. And unfortunately, back then I didn't file a flight plan, and I was just out goofing around, just sightseeing. And I landed on this remote strip. Then when I was taking off, the engine quit, and I had to put it in the trees, and I dragged it out of the trees and fixed it the best I could and flew out.
Now, this was up on the North Slope?
No, this was down west of Wasilla, close to the
So they were big trees, little shrubby trees that you'd have on.
Well, they were about that big round, I guess.
About 5 or 6 inches?
Yeah, 5 or 6 inches, something like that.
Enough to scrape up the fuselage.
Enough to make a lot of noise when the wings hit them.
So how did you just eased it out of the trees then, onto the ground?
Yeah, the trees weren't that big. They were probably 10 feet high. 15 feet high, mm-hmm. and there were mostly new growth willows. And the airplane that I had that happened with an Aronca Chief, it was such a light airplane, only weighed like 650 pounds, 675. And it just kind of floated down into the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just more mad than anything else because, you know, damn it, my engine quit.
What did you do to repair it?
The spar was cracked from the lift strut all the way up to the tip, and the fabric was all torn off, and the last 3 or 4 wooden ribs on the airplane were busted up, and I tore the belly, the trees tore the fabric on the belly, and fortunately I had a nice big fat roll of duct tape, and where the fabric was off the front of the wing, I just duct taped around the spar as much as I could, where the crack was and where I could get to it, and then duct taped all the holes as best I could, and then I just started the engine up. Actually, I didn't start the engine. I had to get in there and figure out why it quit.
Why did it quit?
Yeah, and what happened was the fuel line collapsed. It was apparently too old, and a piece of the inside of the fuel line went and lodged itself up against the carburetor, and I had to take that fuel line off and suck that thing out, and I was like, ooh, nothing like the taste of gas to start your day.
it
was gross, but I got it out of there, put it back on the carburetor, took off, and I realized then that as soon as I got flying speed, I only flew at 60 miles an hour all the way back. It was a long flight. The tip bow was made out of wood, and it was busted. And it came back, and it lodged itself against the aileron like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that I couldn't really turn the airplane. And so I had to yank the wheel to get the aileron out from behind the tip bow to make it turn. That was kind of scary.
So you really didn't feel you had total control.
I felt like I had control, yeah. I did. It was more, to me, I don't know if maybe I'm warped or not, but it was more like an inconvenience than anything else.
Yeah.
And when I got back, and everybody laughed at me as I came taxiing up. You know?
The patched plane.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet you carried duct tape with you ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, if you can't fix it, duck it.
Yeah, it's certainly a wonderful material to have. So you really have to be part mechanic to fly in this country.
Yeah.
And if you don't know, you learn in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had to do some fixing jobs.
Did you take some mechanical courses along with your flight, just on the job?
Just normal major, or normal flight training type stuff. Through the years, I've just learned about on-hand experience on engine and stuff like that. I worked as a mechanics helper for a little while, for about 6 months.
And then you share your stories with other pilots, too, so you learn from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One time, I came in, and the mechanic, what the heck was going on? Somebody was working on the airplane, I forgot who, and I came in, and they were trying to put the valve spring in. And the valve spring on this particular airplane, you can't just kind of push it in, you have to... They call them valve spring compressors, and that's the way you normally do it, but they're sitting there trying to do it, and I came in, oh yeah, I see that, and I just rigged up a little jury-rigged thing, boop, got it in there, and they were like, they were all shocked, how'd you do that, you know, how'd you figure that out? I said, I don't know, just looked at it. I must be kind of mechanically minded, I suppose, because I had to work on my Fairchild quite a bit, because mechanics don't want to touch antique airplanes. Some of them don't, modern ones.
And it would be expensive, too. It's just more...
Yeah.
So...
Mm-hmm. Ooh, excuse me. I had to set up, set the my Fairchild down once because the oil, one of my oil lines collapsed. And it failed, actually, and all the oil started coming out. It was a breather line, and it started coming out all over my window, and luckily I was by Cantwell, and I land there to fix that. One of the hose clamps broke, it failed, and while I was sitting there, I had another hose clamp, while I was sitting there putting that on, I heard, and my tailwheel went flat, and I'm out here in the middle of nowhere. And luckily there was a couple of houses. I went knocking on the door, and one guy there just happened to have a car, so we went to the store and I got some of that silicone, fixed it flat. I mean, just to fix it flat, I got a couple of bottles of that, put it inside the tailwheel, and then had some silicone, and it was the valve stem that broke. And then just jury-rigged it enough to where I could get it to Fairbanks. And then there I just got another tailwheel tube. Put it in there.
It's kind of a panicky feeling to be stuck where you don't think you can get help.
I wasn't panicked as much as just disgusted. You sit there and I just sat there. It's beautiful, hot, sunshiny day, scratching my head.
What do I do now?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were talking earlier in your presentation about the time you were flying in two barrel from Wainwright when you... Your hands got numb.
The carbon monoxide poisoning?
Yes, yeah. Tell about that.
It was scary. One of the most scariest times I've ever had an airplane, is having that carbon monoxide poisoning. I was hauling mail in the 185 by myself. When I flew it to Wainwright and then came back to Barrow, flew out to Akasuk, and when I was on the ground at Akasuk, I realized that I didn't have any strength.
And you didn't have any idea at that point?
I didn't have any idea at that point, no. Akasuk is a half a mile, or half an hour flight away from Barrow, one way. And I get out there, and all of a sudden I just practically collapsed. I just sat on the tailgate, and I said, you guys finish unloading the airplane. And they were shocked because I always unload the airplane. And then I got back in it, took off, and about halfway back, the windows just started fogging up with frosty kind of that stuck to the window. And I was sitting there scraping the window windshield going, what in the world's going on? Couldn't figure it out. And then I don't know how much time it entailed, but all of a sudden I couldn't breathe. And I started getting really scared, and I couldn't feel my face first. And then after that, I couldn't feel my arms or my legs. And I was so scared, I was crying. And then when I didn't sound bad on the radio, otherwise they probably would have said something, but they never did. I got on final and I was starting to gray out. And
By gray out, what do you mean?
Gray out is like the precedes blackout. It's where you start losing your vision, but you can still hear what's going on. I could kind of feel the airplane, and everything, but I'm still conscious, but I'm starting to lose my vision. Everything is starting to turn fuzzy. Mm-hmm. And I got the airplane on the ground. I don't know how in the world I did it. I don't remember. And got onto the ramp. And as soon as I got out of the airplane, I just passed out. And it was about 25 below, 28 below. And I woke up. Nobody even knew I even passed out.
So it was just momentarily.
Yeah. The guys in the flight service station, the place I was working at was right by the flight service station. And they didn't see me until I was just getting up. They didn't realize that I had just passed out. And I don't know how long I was out.
Mm-hmm.
I go inside, hit the warm temperature, and passed out again. And they took me to the hospital. The doctor misdiagnosed it. Another pilot went out and almost got killed in the same airplane. And
so what did the doctor think it was at that point? Just exhaustion or flu?
Hyperventilation.
Oh.
He just thought I was like a teenage girl just hyperventilating because I was all excited, you know. You know? The mechanic was pretty disgusted because they brought me in fireman's carry. Here I am in my pilot clothes. Got my airport tag on me and everything like that. Now, wouldn't you have a natural assumption that you just got out of an airplane, you're going to have CO in your system if you were a doctor? A good one?
Yeah, it would be.
You'd think so? The thing that made him think that I didn't have carbon monoxide poisoning is when you first start to get that, your face turns cherry red, your skin turns cherry red, and then I don't know the physiological reasons why, and then after 30 or 40% of CO in your system, your face turns back to normal color. And apparently I had already gone through that stage.
Through the cherry stage. And so you looked normal.
And the doctor just looked
color.
At me just like this and says, she doesn't have any, she's not cherry red. And so he just made an assumption. And after that, I made a big stink. I got Anchorage involved. It was the Native Hospital and everything like that. And they came down on the doctor. Of course, nothing ever came of it.
Isn't there a blood test where they could have readily told what was wrong?
But he never called for that.
Mm.
And I could have done sudom and stuff like that, but I'm not that kind of a person. I don't like to. I mean, even though I almost died and somebody else almost died because of that.
Mm. And it was the same problem with the other person?
Yeah.
With the muffler, was it the fuel line?
Yeah. No, the muffler.
Muffler.
Failed.
So.
It was the same airplane.
Oh, the same airplane. So
yeah.
It wasn't.
What happened was the doctor misdiagnosed it.
So they didn't think to look?
So they didn't think to look at anything. They just said, okay, you know, she must be all right, whatever. And so they sent the pilot a different pilot on the flight that I was supposed to do to Dead Horse in the same airplane. So he does it, and he succumbs in Dead Horse. And they were smarter than Barra was because they did the blood test and put him in the oxygen tent. And they realized then it was carbon monoxide poisoning.
And then they checked back to see why, and it was the muffler.
It was practically out of its bracket. It was not any kind of maintenance error or anything like that. I want to stress that very highly. It was the manufacturer of the muffler.
So
and that particular manufacturer had a lot of, about 500 incidences of CO poisoning due to failures.
So it was a model defect.
Yeah.
So they were recalled after that?
Yeah, a lot of people weren't quite as lucky as I was. Or this other guy, the other pilot.
So there were deaths from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you fly, you really depend on, first of all, good equipment and then the work of mechanics.
Mm-hmm. And we have a really good maintenance system where I work now. It keeps my
You know, safety
record. They have some of the best equipment in the state.
And I guess now a safety record, well, statewide, is very good because of improvements in equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Because the old bush pilots,
yes,
a lot of them didn't live a full life because
I've had my share of shoddy equipment even in my lifetime.
So it's still a problem, somewhat?
Years ago, not now. It's really difficult to find somebody that's not maintaining the airplanes properly because they wouldn't be discovered nowadays.
So they have these regular checks, too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. After so many hours, then?
Mm-hmm. Every 100 hours we have an inspection, and then every annually we have a big inspection of the airplane.
Is it more stringent in Barrow because of the conditions, or is it more or less the same throughout the industry?
We're pretty stringent. I don't know. I think any of the our remote areas are pretty stringent with their maintenance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of the nature of the
yes, because it's a primary
condition.
Mode of transportation, and we have to have it.
Yeah, really. Without air service,
yeah,
we'd be cut off.
Yeah, I've gone into villages after a week and a half of storms, and they're starving for fresh vegetables or even just some mail, milk. I've had villages run out of milk for babies. And stuff like that.
So you're really a lifeline.
Yeah.
Have you brought injured or sick people into Barrow Hospital? So you've had some emergency situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you? Probably save people.
I took a couple of pregnant women that were in the stages of labor, and I didn't know how close they were because I've never had kids, never been around anybody that had them.
So
I don't know what kind of stage they were in.
You got them there in time.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Yes. So your work really entails just about everything mm-hmm. in terms of serving the communities. Mm-hmm. You say you do regular mail runs and groceries.
Groceries, yeah. Passenger runs. I've delivered Pizza Hut to Aksuk several times and Wainwright several times. They order it. And Pizza Hut freezes it, brings it up on an ordinary cargo, and then I take it out to the villages.
So the pizza comes from Barrow?
From Fairbanks
to Barrow.
Yeah, an ordinary cargo brings it up to Barrow, and then we bring it out to the villages. People get desperate for Pizza Hut pizza apparently. Or even McDonald's. A girlfriend of mine in Barrow went down with a cooler and ordered as many Big Macs as she can stuff in that cooler and froze it. And brought it up to Barrow as baggage.
So that's the next best thing to having your own McDonald's or pizza parlor.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I thought about doing some expediting like that, but I never did.
Yeah.
Get serious.
A weekly pizza run from Fairbanks. Oh, I noticed in reading about you in Bush Pilots of Alaska that you are also an aerobatics pilot. But mm-hmm. What does that entail?
I have been heavily involved in aerobatics in the past.
So these are shows that where you perform?
I did a couple. I didn't get to do very many.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what I was doing, to begin with, I had one of the top people in the country teach me how to do the aerobatics.
Who was that?
Dwayne Cole. He used to do aerobatics in a tailorcraft. He's done air shows all over the country. He's nationally known in aviation circles. So I went down to Texas to get the training from him, and after that I started practicing 2 and 3 hours a day. I was gearing myself up for competition aerobatics.
And what plane would you fly for that? Any particular one?
I was flying a Super Decathlon. I've flown a T-6, which is a World War II trainer plane. I've got about 30 hours in one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of aerobatics in my Luscombe, although it's not really aerobatically rated. But it can do anything you do to it. And I had a Citabria that I did aerobatics with. It didn't have an inverted fuel and oil system in it, though.
Mm-hmm.
I used to just take that one up to 5,000 or 6,000 feet in the summertime and shut the engine off and then just do aerobatics just by gliding. And to me, that's the epitome of real flying.
You actually shut off the engine to do that and then do rolls?
Do everything.
Sort of like
down to maybe 500 feet, and I started getting my low-level aerobatic waiver. And I, with the power on, I could do aerobatics down to 100 feet. I wasn't quite brave enough to do them down lower than that.
And you had faith that the engine would start each time.
You had to.
Yeah.
Of course, aerobatic airplanes are very highly maintained because of that.
Because of that particular feature.
Yeah. Even when I did rent one from an air, from a flight school or whatever, I went in there and inspected and pre-flighted that airplane with a fine-tooth comb before I would go up and do anything in it.
So you knew what to look for.
Yeah.
I guess, some of the stunts that you perform in aerobatics, you might have to, I mean, in terms of starting an engine when it's pitched in a certain way, the skill on maneuvering would be very valuable.
It'd have to be second nature.
Yeah. So really, aerobatics is not only fun, but very practical from the standpoint of...
Adds greatly to your piloting skills.
Yeah, add to your skills, right.
Yeah. And teaches you how to get out of bad situations if you ever got into any. Like let's say, for instance, you somehow bumble into the wake of a 747. And the vortices kind of go around like circles behind the airplane. They kind of go out and down.
Mm-hmm.
And you hit one of those, and it's like hitting a bomb or a wall. It'll just flip you right upside down or do something. And a friend of mine from years ago died from that. He ended up getting in the vortices of a 747 at International in Anchorage and crashed his Citabria. And in this respect, aerobatics helps you to recover the airplane. Like, say the airplane gets turned upside down, and you know what to do instantly.
Mm-hmm. So if you hadn't had that training, you might not know what to do, but, or it wouldn't have come as second nature to you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't want to say that. You don't want to get in that situation in the first place.
Right. Yeah, avoidance, of course, is the best, sometimes that's not possible.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how that guy, in fact, they didn't discover him for a few hours, that he, you know, his wreckage.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, but aerobatics to me has fine-honed my skills in a lot of ways. And also it's fun.
So you do it really for both. Or I guess you don't have time to do it. For fun mostly. And the other is...
Yeah, and actually I did teach aerobatics for a short time. And that's more exciting than it is fun. You never know what that...
You don't have control.
...poor guy's going to do in front of you. What they're going to do to the airplane. You're sitting there, and you, as an instructor, you have to have, like, iron, steel nerves.
Nerves, I bet, yeah, because you're not in control of the plane when they're out there. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've certainly had quite a career in many respects, flying in different areas, your aerobatics, being a bush pilot. Do you have any other plans, future plans? Are you happy what you're doing now, or do you see that as something you will be doing for some time to come? Or
mentally, I'm very happy doing what I'm doing right now. I love flying in the bush. I love the adversity, not as a challenge, but just because it's something you don't get to do down in the States. I love the beauty of it up there. But physically wise, I have arthritis, which is getting to the better part of me, especially from having my back broken and everything like that. It's now migrated into my hips and my neck, my shoulders. So I don't know how many winters I'm going to be able to last now, because if I sit 5, 6, 7 hours in an airplane, my joints feel like they get coagulated. And so I've already planned ahead for that. When that does come to the point where I just can't take it anymore, I'd like to get a ranch with my own airport and a hangar and restore and sell antique airplanes. And that's what my future plans are, at least at this point in time.
So it'll always be airplanes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, probably what will happen before that, at this present time, I'm getting checked out in DC-3 as a co-pilot. And that, to me, is a real airplane to fly. I plan on getting lots of time in that. And it makes me hireable in warmer climates. That's what I have intentions of doing, is at least getting the old airplanes, doing things that most people don't want to do because it's too labor intensive.
But that's what you love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, hearing about...
I've enjoyed talking with you, too. I can sit here and listen to myself talk.
And you are going to be interviewed by Good Morning America in another month or so?
The 18th of this month.
Yeah.
Yeah, they called me up, sent me a ticket to Sitka, and said, be there at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I'll be sure to watch you on TV when the program comes out. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.